Les conférences du Collège de France.
Merci d'être là en ce jour de fête de la musique. Puis, je crois que tu vas y avoir la fête de la musique au Collège de France immédiatement après, il me semble, cette conférence. Et peut-être que ça va commencer avant et qu'on sera un peu gêné. En tout cas, pour l'instant, tout va bien. Et j'ai le grand plaisir d'introduire Robert May pour cette série de conférences. Robert May est professeur de philosophie et de linguistique à UC Davis, professeur émérite. Et il a récemment occupé les fonctions de président du Sénat académique de l'Université de Californie. Mais ce n'est pas pour ça qu'on l'invite, on l'invite pour ses travaux. Et ses travaux concernent deux disciplines. Il est bien connu, il a commencé comme linguiste, avec une thèse à MIT bien connue sur la grammaire de la quantification et qui a fait émerger la notion de forme logique, une notion très importante. Donc il est connu pour ses travaux de linguistique. Mais en philosophie, ça fait longtemps qu'il est philosophe, il est connu pour pas mal de choses, notamment ses travaux sur Frege, qu'il avait exposé à l'occasion notamment de séries de conférences qu'il avait données antérieurement. En 2014, si je ne me trompe pas, il était invité à la fois par l'École normale supérieure et par l'École des hautes études en sciences sociales. Il avait fait une série de conférences sur Frege. Mais il a fait depuis pas mal d'autres séjours à Paris. Et un de ses thèmes de prédilection, c'est, dont il va nous parler dans ses conférences-ci, c'est la sémantique des termes péjoratifs. Et donc dans les conférences qu'il nous propose aujourd'hui et la semaine prochaine, il va nous présenter ses idées, les idées développées notamment en collaboration avec Chris Holm, mais il va les présenter dans un cadre très général. Et donc je me réjouis à l'avance d'entendre son exposé.
Well, thank you all for coming. It's a real pleasure to be here. And I'm going to give a talk today in which I want to explore the meanings of certain kinds of words, how they get those words, how they come to have those meanings, and what those meanings actually are. And this will be tied up with trying to develop some notions as sort of framing background notions having to do with ideology and propaganda. And this part will be sort of, I'm giving two talks. The second talk will be about the semantics of these ideological words, as we'll call them. This is going to be about the meta-semantics. It's going to be about ideas about where the meanings of these words originate and how they get embedded into particular linguistic forms. So, I want to start with what I take it to be a very, very traditional philosophical question. And that's simply the question is, what I've called the question of meaning. What concept is expressed by a given word? Okay. Now, when we talk about this, there's sort of a number of things to parse out here: concept, express, and word. It won't be quite my job there. I'll leave this pretty intuitive. But in terms of concepts, there are two questions which we would normally ask if we're trying to characterize concepts. One would be, how do those concepts describe the fabric of reality? And the second is, how do those concepts compose into assertable thoughts, which would be about that reality? Now, a traditional way of dealing with these questions in philosophy is to deal with them semantically, and to ask the question, what is the semantic space that's carved out by a concept, and then argue that a linguistic form tags or flags this particular conceptual space. So one would give a theory of concepts, it gives a certain kind of space, a semantic space, and then the question is, how do words reflect or attach that and hence express those concepts? Now, if we take this perspective, there are two questions which arise. The first is the meta-semantic question. What's the source of word meanings? What is the etiology of concepts or the concepts that constitutes those meanings? So taken in this perspective, a concept is going to be the meaning of a word. The semantic question would then be, how does their meaning contribute to the meaning of sentences? And this ultimately comes to the question of truth conditions. So what I'm going to try to do today in the first part is to set up a framework for understanding how aspects of social meaning become actualized in language and language use, and how certain socially based concepts carve semantic spaces. Mind you, my goal is to set a framework. I will not be very critical at all. In fact, I'll offer little criticism of other perspectives, but rather to set up a framework to get to certain questions about the nature of the meanings of certain words. So the words I want to talk about, just as a quick overview of what I'll be talking about, is going to be the metasemantics and semantics, what we'll call ideological words. And these are going to be words whose the concepts they express are the abstracts of an ideology. And in some sense, we can argue that they capture the essence of an ideology. We may think of them as theoretical terms of the ideology in a way that I'll characterize. And moreover, that the use of such words indicates subscription to the ideology by an individual. Specific words that I want to be discussing are pejorative words, which I'm going to argue are ideological words of defective ideologies. And these, what are these ideologies? These are racism, anti-Semitism, homophobia, Islamophobia, the epithets that are associated with those and other comparable ideologies. And the question will be, what concepts do those words express, those epithets, and what do they mean? Okay? And the fundamental idea we're going to be working with is that the concepts they express are fundamentally and essentially unsatisfiable. And that will be one of the fundamental notions we're going to be exploring. Okay, so I said I want to set up a framework, and here's the kind of framework I want to set up to be able to discuss the notion of ideology. Okay? And we're going to take it that ideologies are a form of folk social theory. As theories, they have a subject matter. Those are the things that are targeted by the ideology. Okay? And what is targeted may pre-theoretically have very unclear borders. That's part of what the ideology will do. It'll persistify those, it'll be persistified by the theory of the ideology. Ideologies have principles, as a theory would. And these are intended to have explanatory and predictive value over the subject matter. And they're going to ground or justify values or worth, positive or negative, of the subject matter. Ideologies are normative theories. They provide guidance for what one ought to do and be in society. And finally, ideologies are folk theories in the sense that they do not depend on endorsement from experts, although they may generate within themselves figures of authority who get to be experts in it, but it does not require such expertise. So ideologies typically focus on particular social properties of race, gender, sexual or religious orientation, socioeconomic status, and the like, but they can also be much more mundane than these. So here are a few examples. Racism, white supremacy, misogyny, anti-Semitism, Catholicism, capitalism, environmentalism, the NCAA Charter, for those of you not familiar with that, the NCAA is the governing body of intercollegiate sports in the United States. Astrology, farm-to-table cuisine, academic freedom, one of my favorite ones that I like to talk about, etc. And in general, we can sort of isolate out certain characteristics that ideologies in this sense have. They can be fictional or non-fictional. They can be based in fact or fantasy. And which it is something which is sort of open to dispute. So take religion, which I think you might say is completely fictional, based in a complete fiction, but there's a lot of people who would want to argue, you know, for creationism as literally being true. Okay. Marxism, sort of the opposite way, right? Marxism claims to be founded in non-fictional and reality, but others would think not, that their constructions are in fact fictional. Ideologies can have saliency and vitality. They can come and go. They can be born, they can die. They can recede to the background or they can be up front. That's a very complicated fact of historical, political, social, and cultural factors in any given moment in time, which will determine the saliency of a given ideology in the society. They can be culturally and socially central or marginal. And part of the dynamic of understanding ideologies would be how they can move back and forth between the center and the margins. So, for example, well, I guess here too, in the United States, sort of racism and white supremacy is certainly moving from a more marginal position into a more central position, or trying to. And finally, they would be, these ideologies seen as theories would be open to critical scrutiny. One can, you know, they're open to philosophical investigation and conceptual discussion. Now, ideologies, in our view, can be good or bad. They can be positive or negative. They can be just or unjust. The notion of ideology itself doesn't determine it. There can be good ideologies and bad ideologies. Okay? And that will be determined by the nature of the propositions that constitute the theory, that is, the ideology. But it's not inherent in the notion of ideology itself. So I think in this view that I'm having, I will do one point of comparison, is that a number of contemporary writers on ideology have seen it as only negative. So here's a quote from Haslinger. An ideology is a cultural techne, the web of meaning, symbols, scripts, and such that function to create or stabilize unjust social relations. Or Shelby, an ideology is a widely held set of loosely assorted beliefs and implicit judgments that misrepresent significant social realities and that function through this distortion to bring about or perpetuate unjust social relations. I think that's true, pretty close to true, of unjust ideologies, but not as a definition of ideology itself. So ideological propositions. So theories are generally made up of sets of axiomatic propositions. And so we can take ideologies qua theories as some set of propositions in which we could characterize two different kinds. Descriptive contents, those are going to be propositions that are true or false at some world in a time. So for example, in the ideology of misogyny, there would be the descriptive proposition, women earn less than men for the same job now in the United States, for example. Or racism, black people are less intelligent than white people. But they also will have normative contents in the ideology. These will be prescriptions that are filled or unfilled, again, at a world and a time. So again, just to continue the case of misogyny, this would be the claim that women should earn less than men. One ought to pay women less for the same job as men. And of course, to buy into an ideology, you don't have to believe both. You could believe that women should earn less than men for the same job, but that they don't. It happens that they turn out that they do earn the same. Okay, so I said these were folk social theories. I've focused on theory. But as social theories, ideologies are typically complex, detailed representations of ways of life. And connected to them, people may have various complex relationships. They may be related to their own personal identity. Holding an ideology may very much make up the personal identity of a person. It can guide the nature of social roles and structures, the roles people play in society. Try to establish social hierarchies, who are to be higher or lower in various ways. Develop conventions and expectations of behavior, and set values and various requirements and prohibitions. All these kinds of things will be types of things that ideologies will set forth propositions about what is and what ought to be. So in general, ideologies as social theory are theories about how people should be placed and behave and the beliefs they should have in the social and cultural fabric. Now, if we have an ideology, there's another part. We have to have people who are subscribers to the ideology. These are the agents that vitalize the ideology. And there's some characteristics of people who are subscribers to a given ideology. First, they believe in it, in the ideology. So one believes in Catholicism, believes in racism, believes in environmentalism. So this notion of believing in seems to be significant for a subscriber. In the sense that they, in believing in an ideology, they embrace the ideology. They become, so to speak, the psychological instantiation or the cognitive realization of the ideology. And that may be overt, or it may be repressed belief of core ideological tenets. So one may have implicit bias, for example, which would be sort of a covert holding of an ideology, which one may not be willing to enunciate. Typically, subscribers are disposed to certain normative practices. They are prone to act out certain events which are legitimized by the ideology. And subscribers may be committed to a degree. So they may be casual. They may not be particularly explicit about it. They might even deny it. But they may exhibit practices and behaviors that are ideologically and sympathetic to the ideology. Then there are the actives people. Those are explicit, ardent, card-carrying, so to speak, subscribers to the ideology. And finally, there are those who are radicalized, the strongest subscribers, most willing to act out. So I like to think about this as, you know, if you think about anti-Semitism, you know, in the United States anyway, you'd have the sort of so-called country club anti-Semite, the one who, you know, it's perfectly okay for them to come have dinner with them, and they're perfectly nice people, even do business with, but, you know, they just can't be members of the country club or marry my daughter. Then there may be those who are active anti-Semites and undertake all sorts of anti-Semitic activities, and those who are radicalized, you know, the skinhead who has the swastika tattooed in his head and so on. Now, this process where we can sort of see people in the sort of different ways in their relation to the ideology allows for a form of radicalization, those who are the really radical subscribers to it, okay? And perhaps the way we can sort of, you know, as a metaphor way of thinking about this, we can go back to Quine from Two Dogs of Empiricism, his famous notion of sort of a web of belief, and think of this as a web of ideology, where we could represent ideological beliefs as holistically connected points in a kind of interconnected web. And following Quine, closer to the center of this web are the ones which would have greater recalcitrance to revision. So at the ideological center would be the beliefs most essential to one's identity and values as a subscriber. Okay? So depending on how you sort of articulate yourself in this web of belief relative to, say, greater strength from the center to the periphery, you would be either you could be just a believer or just a subscriber, or you could be radicalized. So radicalization would be centering ideological beliefs to the exclusion of other social norms and ethical values. When you're truly radicalized, the ideology becomes totally your way, the core way of seeing becomes totally your way of seeing the world. And this tends to enable and justify extreme actions that might violate mainstream social norms and ethical values in terms of all sorts of political activities. For example, bombing a synagogue, becoming a nun, and various kinds of activities that would go with being highly radicalized to the ideology. Radical subscribers, of course, are very valuable because they are the ones who are central to perpetuating the ideology. And more often than not, the leaders of an ideological movement will typically be the radical subscribers. Now, the next part of the ideology is that we have the sort of the theory, we have those who subscribe to the theory, and then we have the institutionalization of the ideology. So an institution in this regard is going to be a social and cultural conventionalization of an ideology. And this will be commonly manifested by some kind of organization, which takes the role of conventionalizing practices motivated and justified by the ideology. And among the things that it will do, it will fix acceptable ways of acting out the ideology. Okay? And any given institution, bear in mind, may not be a simple institution about a given ideology. Institutions tend to be very complex and often incorporate a melange of various ideologies of different sorts. Okay? Ideological institutions are commonly physically realized. They can be realized in bricks and mortar. They can be done online. But this is not a necessary characteristic of institutionalization. Okay? There need be no sort of physical embodiment of it. It tends to have, again, insofar as it's trying to establish itself, it'll tend to have well-defined leadership. It'll involve lawyers, political and financial consultants, lobbyists, marketeers, fundraising staff, security, and so on, as things become highly organized. So here are some examples. The National Rifle Association, that's the lobbying organization in the United States, which claims to be upholding the Second Amendment and the right for Americans to kill whomever they want. The Republican National Committee, it's a political party. United Auto Workers, a union. The University of California, a university, another example of an institution which realizes an ideology. So what are the purposes of institutionalization? Well, it's a form of maturation. An ideological institution is fully matured when it becomes an integral part of mainstream society. It dictates to subscribers who they are, what to value, and how to behave. It carves out, ultimately, a permissible way of life. and there's a cognitive recession into the center of the web of ideological beliefs. The beliefs become fully backgrounded, and norms become dominant social norms. So it comes embedded within overarching social institutions: government, education, business, religion, law. So, for example, you know, should government support particular religions or not? Okay, that would be an attempt to have this become basically embed itself, embed religion within government. Okay, and this can end going indeed to the center of society itself. In this regard, ideological institutions become fully backgrounded. They just become part of our lives by becoming completely mainstreamed. So here are examples, I think, of some fully matured mainstream ideologies: capitalism, misogyny, Christianity, white supremacy. Propaganda is the communication put forward by ideological institutions to support and advance their goals. It promotes or advertises the ideology and its institutionalization. It sets the framing story, and it's a tool to recruit new subscribers, expand social influence, and reinforce acceptance by current subscribers. And it's often directed at causing emotive responses, comfort or discomfort. Okay, so, you know, you can imagine all sorts of propaganda which is designed to basically affect you in certain ways. So it's typically disseminated aesthetically by manipulating media through literature, broadsheets, manifestos, speeches, posters, film, photos, paintings, etc. They can be linguistic or pictorial modes, and is intended to apply directly or indirectly core ideological propositions. Ooh, I'm moving. This is going much faster than I thought it was going to go. I'll have a lot of time for questions. Okay, so propaganda, I mean, is a very complex phenomenon. There's a lot to say about it. But to take a rough cut, we can talk about two forms of propaganda: what we might call pragmatic propaganda, and then I'll turn to what case I really want to discuss today, which is semantic propaganda. So propaganda can be a force to mainstream ideologies, to bring them into the mainstream, where the goal is to embed ideological propositions as socially accepted background presuppositions of everyday life. They, so to speak, they accrete, so to speak, to a conversational common ground, part of the presuppositions we have in our social interactions and in our conversations. This ideology may play out in the context of a notion of social meaning, where we can think of social meaning as an interaction between literal meaning and background social presuppositions. Okay? And then we'll derive actions compatible with the ideology's tenets in virtue of this interaction. So here's an example from misogyny again. So take the word mother. Its literal meaning is female parent. There's a misogynist presupposition: females are caregivers, and this is an essential property of females, that they are caregivers. And then from that, we can derive actions which are compatible with the ideologies, we can derive the negative inference of women's role and advancement in professional context. So we take this sort of underlying presupposition, which has been embedded into society, and which, of course, many people are, you know, attempts to remove. But if you take it that way, we can get this implication. So the use of terms explicitly keyed to their use of terms that are explicitly keyed to these ideological social presuppositions, they're usually called dog whistles. And when these terms are used, it's meant to stir up these background presuppositions. But when one speaks in this way, the keying the presupposition, that they're keyed to presuppositions, allows for plausible deniability. So now I want to turn to the case I really want to discuss, and I'll discuss today and tomorrow. Really, I've only been going for 25 minutes.
That's what you mean.
So semantic propaganda are literal expressions of ideological propositions. And these can be things such as speeches by ideologues, mission statements, manifestos, bylaws, press releases, etc. And they are explicit assertions of the ideology's principles and propositions. So as an example, it might have made the news here about a month or so ago, maybe 2 months ago, an American football player named Harrison Butker gave a college commencement speech in which he just just was a completely misogynist rant about the fact that women should not be seeking careers, that their role was in the home, and so on and so forth, just simply a screed of misogynist assertions. However, outside of just this kind of overt assertion of the propositions of an ideology, there are what we're going to call, and what we're going to be discussing, ideological words. And these words are special linguistic symbols of the ideology. And it's a characteristic of subscribing agents that they commonly act out linguistically by accessing certain special linguistic expressions. And what I want to talk about for the remainder of this time and next week what is the meaning of these words? What's their semantic content? And I'll argue that it derives from an ideology, that they're, so to speak, a theoretical encapsulation of the fundamental core sort of notion of the ideology. Its use derives from institutional norms setting conditions for allowable linguistic behavior. Remember, one of the things that when ideologies get institutionalized, they set norms, and among the norms they set are what it counts as proper use of language. And a given utterance derives from subscribers' attitudes that dispose them to or causes their linguistic acts. So let me now start, and in the remainder of the talk, and we're going to have lots of time for discussion, let me first introduce this notion of a theoretical abstract. Now remember, I'm thinking about ideologies as theories, as a type of folk social theory. So I want to call a notion of theoretical abstract is what subscribers to the ideology have in common that justifies and supports their subscription to the ideology and their behavior consistent with the norms it establishes. So it's going to express an abstraction from particular justifications which may vary between subscribers to the ideology. Especially in ideologies we're discussing, so if you think about something like anti-Semitism, racism, those kinds of things, and you ask people, what are the problems you have, they'll just come up with the most wackadoodle stuff. I mean, all sorts of crazy things. And so what we really want to be able to get at is, well, what's the core, what's the common thread that goes through this? And that's the part of analysis, to try and figure out in abstract, what's the common thread that goes among all the various justifications that individual subscribers might give? And so the thesis is that ideological words, they encapsulate the core theoretical abstract of the ideology, and they express these concepts as their meaning. So here's a simple example, the theoretical abstract of farm-to-table cuisine. Okay, these are people who eat what is ecologically sustainable and locally sourced, okay? And our ideological word for this is locavore, okay? So that locavore captures this essential aspect of the farm-to-table cuisine as an ideology, even though any given individual, if you ask them, well, what counts as farm-to-table may give you very, very variant different things. But what would run through it is ought to be a notion of ecological sustainability and local sourcing. Okay, now we turn to pejorative words. Pejorative words are the ideological words of morally defective ideologies. These are racism, anti-Semitism, Islamophobia, homophobia, etc., etc., etc. The pejoratives encapsulate the core theoretical abstract of an ideology. And they target those who are morally evaluable under the terms of the ideology. So what's the abstract that sort of characterizes the kind of semantic space, the concept that characterizes the semantic space occupied by pejorative words? It's something like this. People ought to be the target of negative moral evaluation just because of being a G, where a G is going to be filled in by being black, Jewish, Muslim, gay, whatever it might be. Okay? And generally, with an ideology, those terms will be taken and argued to be ideologically natural kinds, even though we know that under examination, there may be the edges of it might be very, very, very fuzzy. The ideology will take it to be a natural kind, and will provide various kinds of methods, perhaps for persistifying those, what the barriers, what the sort of the boundaries of the concept are. Think of, you know, Nazi Germany and various tests for who were Jewish. Okay, so those were practical tests to find whether a given individual was Jewish or not, given that the notion of being Jewish was an ideologically natural kind. Mind you, I take it that this is not, ideological natural kinds cannot, you know, may not be, and in most cases are not actual natural kinds. So N-star, the N-word, means ought to be the target of negative moral evaluation just because of being black. K-star, the K-word in English, means ought to be the target of negative moral evaluation just because of being Jewish. So what characterizes and what's sort of the core of this is that the concept will have the following characteristics. It will be normative, it will be moral, it'll be negative, and it'll be targeted. Okay, those are the four characteristics that we're trying to capture in this locution. So to call someone an N star, to call someone a K star, is to say they lack moral worth. And of course, to say that someone lacks moral worth is fundamentally dehumanizing. So these kinds of words, of course, carry a strong sense of dehumanization, because those without moral worth are exactly those who are dehumanized. And so we know the power of these words in context. And so when we wish to use them, for example, to dehumanize an enemy in war, we always have various kinds of pejorative terms for them, which are standardly used to justify and hopefully ameliorate the psychological pain and torture that comes with killing another human being. Pejorative words, pejorative concepts, however, are corrupt. They are fundamentally corrupt. No one ought to be the target of negative moral evaluation just because of being a Jew. No one ought to be the target of negative moral evaluation just because they're black, Jewish, Muslim, or whatever else. It's simply a violation of an a priori moral principle. So, because of this, because there is no one, this is what we would call a null extension, pejorative words express unsatisfiable, morally corrupt concepts. These are concepts which are fundamentally unsatisfiable. So, N-star expresses, if you a Frege-ian like me, you'll say, expresses a sense whose reference is a concept with a null extension. So pejorative words like the N-word are to be analogized in this regard to words like unicorn, right? These are mythological terms from a certain ideology about, you know, about the powers of unicorn horns and what unicorns are and so on. But it's a mythological fictional term with null extension. We all know the word. We all know what, and I would argue, we all know what the word means. And I think exactly the same thing is true of all the pejorative words. We know these words. Everyone knows these words. But one thing to know about them is to know that they do not have an extension. So just like we know that unicorn, there are no such things as unicorns, we also know that there are no such things as N's and there are no such things as K's. So an ideology with sort of empty theoretical terms, if we take these notions as kind of theoretical terms insofar as they capture fundamental concepts of the ideology, is a defective ideology. Any such one would be defective. And pejoratives are the corrupt language of morally defective ideologies. Given this, we can sort of say, well, you know, we have an idea of what the pathology of racism is. The pathology of racism is a belief that denies an a priori moral truth. Racists believe that there are people who ought to be the target of negative moral evaluation just because of being black or Jewish or Muslim or whatever it might be. Okay? And on my view, this is actually a psychological pathology. There's something deeply pathological about racist anti-Semitic beliefs, okay? Because you have a belief that essentially fundamentally violates an a priori moral truth. Now, racism, I think this is a fundamental, essential character of racism, is the denial, is to have this false belief. But of course, racist attitudes and all the other you know, Mishragasa goes along with racism is all part of fundamentally understanding what racism is. So this is not meant as a definition of racism, but what it is meant to do is to characterize something very, very fundamental about it, that it involves a fundamental flaw, it's fundamentally corrupt, and then it denies an a priori moral truth. So I'm going to end, and we'll have lots of time for discussion. I thought at least we'd go a little longer. Notice that now, given that we have this way of thinking about these ideologies like racism, that we can make a distinction, which I think in the contemporary discussion, particularly in the United States, I'm sure here too, is important, between racism and racists, those who affirmatively hold or affirmatively holding the false belief. Racists affirmatively hold a false belief that there are people who ought to be targets of negative moral evaluation just because they are this or that. Non-racism non-racist is someone who denies holding the false belief. Just says, I don't hold that belief. Okay? So I'm okay because I don't hold that belief. An anti-racist is someone who denies the false belief and understands truly what these words mean. They are not in the deluded state. Racism is a delusion. It's a fundamental delusion. It's to believe something which is not true of the world. It's to believe that there are such things as part of the fabric of reality, that there are ends and K's and so on as part of the fabric of reality. But in fact, there are not such things. There are Jewish people, there are black people, there are Muslim people, but there are not ends, K's, and whatever are M's and so on and so forth. Right? So what's happened, of course, in the United States is the people are saying, look, we've gone to a post-racist society and I'm a non-racist. Okay, but in fact, do we really think that Donald Trump is not a racist? Okay, he'll certainly say I'm a non-racist, but do we truly believe he's not a racist? So non-racists and anti-racists will both demur from uttering pejorative terms. They won't utter words like the N-word and the K-word. They never would, right? They'd think it would be, for all sorts of reasons, they would just never do it. Either it's impolite, or you know, you just don't do it in nice company, or others who just say, I never say that word because I know what it means, and to say it is to say something false with all the implications that may have, which I'll talk about in the next talk. But arguably, and I think this is true, non-racists are still racist because they do not fully deny the false belief. So let me stop there. I hope there's some time. There'll be lots of times for questions. I'll take up all the time next time, knowing I went a little too quickly. But the idea will be next time to look at the semantics of these words. Okay? And if we take it that they have a null extension, there's going to be certain definite consequences. So for example, the sentence, there are ends on this view, comes out as false, right? Because there are no such things, so it's simply false. It's a false assertion. There are positions in the philosophical literature in which it's claimed that is true. Okay? And I'm going to discuss those next time because I think this is very problematic, because it should not be that if it's the case that, that comes out as true, it would seem that you would have a philosophical theory that implies racism. And I don't think that our philosophical theories should do that. And I'll explain why that is in my next talk. So thank you very much, and I hope you have some questions.
Retrouvez tous les contenus du Collège de France sur www.college-de-france.fr.